From Iowa Public Radio News, I'm Ben Kiefer. This is The Exchange. We start today with an update on Iowa connections to the earthquake in Haiti. At least one Iowan has been killed in the quake. Then we preview this week's conference at Drake University about children's issues. We talk about children and the military and growing up during a war. Chris Gleason of ISU's Operation Military Kids will join us. Also, Tim Lane and Megan Harris from the Iowa Department of Public Health on the childhood obesity epidemic. And Amy Junkie of Lutheran Services of Iowa will tell us about the challenges and joys of making child refugees feel at home in the state. That's all coming up. First, this look at the news. This is The Exchange from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer, and we want to devote most of the hour to a conference on children's issues going on tomorrow at Drake University. But first, updates on a couple of Iowa connections to the earthquake in Haiti. As news continues to filter out of Haiti, we are getting a better understanding of the devastation in that Caribbean country following Tuesday's earthquake. Sad news to report from the Wartburg Theological Seminary, where Reverend Dwayne Larson disclosed in a news release yesterday that seminary student Ben Larson was killed in Tuesday's earthquake. Ben Larson was one of four Wartburg students in Haiti working on various January term projects. A press release issued by Wartburg Wednesday said the other three, Jonathan Larson, Ben's cousin, Renee Larson, Ben's wife, are reported safe. Also, the fourth student from Wartburg, Sarah Thompson, also reported safe. According to the Wartburg news release, Renee Larson, Jonathan Larson, and Ben Larson were in the same building when the quake hit. Renee and Jonathan made it out. Ben did not. Ben and Jonathan had been invited to teach lay leaders in Haiti. Renee was working on a thesis. Renee and Jonathan plan to return to the U.S. this week. Just 6 hours before the devastating earthquake in Haiti on Tuesday, a group of six Iowans from Pella landed in the Haitian capital of Port-au-Prince. The four women and two men are on a mission trip from Grace Fellowship Christian Reformed Church in Pella. Earlier today, I spoke with the church's pastor, Roger DeWard. Pastor DeWard, what contact have you had with the members of your church since the earthquake?
We've had brief contact with them via Facebook, several posts on Facebook, and then some emails that have been sent directly from them to their family members, and that's been it.
Is that Wednesday and today, Thursday?
Actually, the first contact we had was Tuesday evening, and we didn't have anything yesterday, Wednesday, and then we got a couple of more messages today.
Mm-hmm. And what was the content of those messages? Everybody okay, we hope?
Yes. We found out in the evening Tuesday that they had arrived at their final destination and were okay. A very brief message that they felt the earthquake and there was minimal damage where they were, but that they were fine. Then we received some information about what they did yesterday. They were able to spend some time with the kids in the orphanage that they're working at, and sounded like they had a pretty good day. And then they're attempting to get out of the country is what it sounds like right now. So,
So they arrived in Haiti's capital, Port-au-Prince. Is that where the orphanage is located?
No, they did arrive in Port-au-Prince. The orphanage is actually about 40, 45 miles north of Port-au-Prince, and so they traveled from the airport to the final destination.
Mm-hmm. And their mission was to be?
They were just going to go there and spend time with the kids. My understanding is that the place they're at is kind of a combination of an orphanage and a school for deaf kids. And they were going to spend time in both of those places, just being with the kids and doing crafts and just playing with them and caring for them and that sort of thing.
How large is the group?
There are six people.
All Iowans from Pella?
That's correct.
From the Grace Fellowship Christian Reformed Church?
That's correct.
Mm-hmm. I understand you held an impromptu prayer service on Tuesday night after hearing of the disaster.
Yeah. As soon as we heard, we tried to kind of reach out to our community here at Grace, and just invited people to come and pray and talk with each other. And when we did that, we didn't have any information other than that they were supposed to have arrived. By the time we actually got together, we knew that they were safe, and so we were celebrating that news, but then continuing to pray for mm-hmm. for their safety.
Tell me more about the prayer service on Tuesday night. What was the atmosphere like?
Well, as I said, since we had received word that they were okay, it was we were celebrating that, and so it was a relief. There was some, you know, obviously some joy, laughter, but there were some tears because, you know, they weren't home. So we just sort of talked with each other a little bit and gathered in a circle and prayed, and we felt like that was the best thing we could do, and it was a really neat atmosphere. We were able to have some of the family members here and kind of care for them, and it was just a good time to be together.
Can you give us a description of the group, their names, ages, and so forth?
At this point, we're not releasing the names from the church. We're just, out of respect for the families, we've just committed to them that we won't give the names out. As you might imagine, our primary focus is on caring for the families who are still here and worrying about their loved ones. I can tell you there are four women and two men, mm-hmm. And they have families that are a part of our church here.
But according to the information you have through Facebook, the communication that you have, all six members of your church are safe.
That's correct.
No injuries.
Not that we're aware of, no.
Okay. So this changes, obviously, what they wanted to do. You mentioned they will be trying to get out of Haiti and come back immediately?
Well, the details on that are a little sketchy. What we know is that there's a possibility they're attempting to get to the U.S. Embassy and then be transported from there, but we really don't have any details on that.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, it appears that they're going to attempt to come home sooner than they had planned.
There's no thought of them somehow helping in the relief effort?
Not that I'm aware of, no.
Okay. Well, Pastor DeWard, we certainly, of course, will keep your church members in our thoughts and prayers in the coming days, and hope they return to Iowa in very good shape.
Yeah, well, we appreciate that. The outpouring that we have received has been overwhelming. People have expressed all sorts of well wishes to us and prayers, and it's just been a really neat thing to watch a community come together.
Very good. Thank you very much. Pastor Roger DeWard of Grace Fellowship Christian Reformed Church in Pella, Iowa. That conversation recorded earlier today. This is The Exchange from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Children's issues will be the focus of the 4th Annual Innovation and Leadership Conference at Drake University tomorrow, Friday. The conference, which is open to the public, will explore the future of our culture based on policies and programs that relate to children. Multiple sessions featuring local leaders will discuss a wide variety of issues as they relate to children, poverty, and the role of education in breaking the cycle, the future of Iowa's juvenile justice system, children and the military, obesity and nutrition, refugees and immigration, sexual abuse, sex trafficking and pornography, and issues facing Iowa's teens. Drake's Center for Professional Studies and the Iowa Department of Administrative Services are sponsoring the conference, and in the remainder of the hour, we'd like to touch on some of the children's issues with several experts featured at the conference. Let's first go to Amy Junkie. She is in Iowa Public Radio Studios in Des Moines. She is Director of Communications and Marketing at Lutheran Services of Iowa. Lutheran Services in Iowa has partnered with Catholic Charities to form Refugee Cooperative Services. And this is a program that has resettled over 3,600 refugees in Iowa since 1998. Good afternoon to you, Amy.
Good afternoon. Thanks for having me on.
We'll get your microphone on. Amy Junkie with us. You are active in refugee settlement in the state, helping people live in refugee camps who have lost their homes, livelihoods, and likely some of their family members. As we look at the scale of the human tragedy in Haiti as it unfolds here, is this a disaster that will likely produce refugees leaving the island of Haiti, as Katrina did, possibly even having refugees from Haiti headed for Iowa?
Well, that's very possible. The definition of a refugee is someone who has fled their country for fear of persecution. It could be for political beliefs, religious beliefs, or you know, reasons similar to those. So it's very possible. You know, when you don't have a safe place, and you flee, then you can, you know, you would take refuge in a refugee camp and then hopefully become resettled to the United States.
Mm-hmm. So are Lutheran services and the Catholic Charities, the partnered organizations here, looking into this in terms of Haiti already? Are there feelers out?
Well, I'll tell you what, it's actually, on a nationwide platform. We, as a nation, we set a limit every year of how many refugees will be resettled in the United States. It's then divided what countries, you know, those can come from, and then how many will go to each state. So it's not exactly in, you know, we can't choose and you say we'd like to bring some, survivors of a Haiti tragedy here to the United States. But we certainly look to those trends to help plan, for who those populations might be. We've definitely seen an increase in Iraqi refugees in the past few years, and that's for obvious reasons. So we absolutely, you know, look at this, and obviously our hearts go out to everyone in that nation and everyone connected to someone there, and that's something we will look ahead to.
Okay. You mentioned the Iraq refugees. What are the list off some of the other crises in the recent past that have brought refugees to the United States, to Iowa?
Well, absolutely. We have a lot of people from Rwanda. I think most people are familiar with the genocide. A family or an individual can live in a refugee camp for 20 years before they actually are resettled to another country. So we have Asian region refugees. We actually get a lot of refugees from Africa and those nations. So I also think maybe the general public, something like Rwanda that may to the general public seem a long time ago, we are just now, you know, seeing maybe an influx of population from that area. And it's just so diverse, and it's on a national and international level. It's going to fluctuate. So
okay, very good. Amy, we have to take a short break, then we'll be back with you and other experts who are being featured this week, or rather tomorrow, at a Drake conference on children's issues. And when we come back, we'll talk more about the fact that there have been over 3,600 refugees resettled in Iowa since 1998. Maybe you're someone who knows a refugee who's been resettled, or a refugee yourself who would like to join our conversation. 1-866-780-9100. Or The Exchange at iowapublicradio.org. Talking more broadly about children's issues for the remainder of the hour, what do you see as the most pressing issues facing children in Iowa? 1-866-780-9100. When we come back, we'll talk about children's obesity and also Operation Military Kids, among other things. This is The Exchange from Iowa Public Radio News. Children's issues, the focus of the 4th Annual Innovation and Leadership Conference at Drake University tomorrow. That's what we're focusing on for the remainder of the hour, with several experts who will be at that conference, including Amy Junkie of Lutheran Services of Iowa, talking about refugee children who find their way to Iowa's borders to live in our state and to be resettled. And picking up on our conversation before the break, Amy, put us in the shoes of a refugee. Help us understand the realities of being a refugee, especially a child refugee.
Sure. I was kind of thinking, we're talking about Haiti. I think a lot of similar things that they will go through. We get individuals, some families, here in Des Moines. And a lot of times those families will leave behind maybe a sister and a grandmother, or a sister and a brother and an uncle. So often you can imagine that joy of finally finding freedom and peace, but leaving your loved ones behind, and maybe you don't see them for another 10 years. A lot of our refugees literally escape with their lives, so they have no idea what happened to their families. And so it's amazing when you can see refugees arrive at the airport, and if they are reuniting with some family, we actually have volunteers that their job is to give hugs to still welcome.
Really?
It's the greatest
volunteer. That's a nice job to have.
Right. So if you can just imagine, you know, in the middle of the night, you know, fleeing literally for your life and not knowing where your family is, if they're safe. So when they are reunited, that's wonderful. But, you know, the reality is many people come here and they don't know anyone. So mm-hmm. you don't choose where you're going to be resettled to. Many refugees have never seen snow. So imagine being resettled the past few weeks in Iowa.
Exactly.
So we use a lot of donations and volunteers to set up an apartment. And we greet them at the airport, take them to an apartment. And depending on how long they've been in a refugee camp or where they are from, we show them anything from how running water works to how to mail a letter. A big piece of that is showing them the bus system. And we basically have funding, say, for a family. We have about three months to get jobs for the refugees who obviously English is second language is at best. So, you know, they have 3 months to learn a language, get a job, get accustomed to, mm-hmm. You know, where to find food, you know, not to cross the street, you know, just in the middle of traffic, just things that we really take for granted that refugees have to learn in a matter of days. So,
of course, this is wonderful to help out needy people from across the world for whatever political reasons or that they cannot live in their own home countries. But we do in Iowa benefit from having them within our borders, don't we?
Exactly. It's amazing. We have a refugee community center. That's where refugees can come in and where English is second language classes are, things like that. But really, the greatest thing about that center is what the refugees bring every day. You know, we adapt into our culture, pieces of their culture, whether it's food or art or, you know, new relationships and our global understanding of what's outside of Des Moines, what's outside of Iowa, what's outside of the United States. They enrich our lives, and it's amazing, you know, what kind of transitions we can see in our lives just when we are touched directly or indirectly by a refugee.
Mm-hmm. Let's suppose listeners out there, some of them are interested in this and would like to somehow help out, resettle refugees. Is there any way to find out more and possibly do that?
Sure. That's great. We you can go to our website. It's lsiowa.org. And we have wonderful volunteers. We only have, I believe right now, 6 full-time staff. And last year we resettled over 450 refugees. Mm. So we do rely on our wonderful volunteers to, like I said, you know, possibly set up apartments, but also to teach those classes, to provide daycare so that families can learn English, can get those job skills and other skills.
Mm-hmm. So how many resources, and both in terms of human resources, the volunteers you just mentioned, and material resources, does it take to resettle a single refugee? Have you quantified that?
Well, we can kind of put a dollar value on that, but I don't think that's even accurate. It does vary a little bit, you know, towards the refugee and what their experiences are, but it takes a whole community. You know, we've had volunteers just attach themselves to the families and just become friends of the family because they don't have transportation to a doctor's visit. It's amazing, again, what we take for granted, that we can hop in our cars and get taken care of. Well, when you don't have transportation and you don't know who to ask or how to ask, the resources are just unlimited that it takes to really just resettle one person in the community.
Amy Junkie, Director of Communications and Marketing at Lutheran Services of Iowa. Amy, joining you in the studio there at Iowa Public Radio in Des Moines is Tim Lane. He is a community health consultant for the Iowa Department of Public Health, also featured at this conference tomorrow on innovation and leadership that's dealing with children's issues. Good afternoon to you, Tim.
Good afternoon, Ben.
This is interesting because we wanted to address obesity, something that you deal with, obesity in children. We just heard on Morning Edition this morning, the obesity epidemic in the United States appears to have hit a plateau, according to that report, with one exception. Males, boys between the ages of 6 and 19, they're still getting bigger. So putting the question of boys to the side for a minute, are we in any way starting to turn a corner in terms of raising awareness about the problem of childhood obesity?
I would say the answer to that question is yes. For the last decade, we have worked on raising the awareness, and programs have been developing, efforts have been initiated, and collaboration has become stronger and stronger over that period of time, so that, those entities that are concerned about this particular issue are being more effective. For example, you know, we could say that Iowa's rate, which is 27% of our children that were overweight or obese, you know, is better off than 32% nationally. You know, but it's nothing that we want to, you know, even brag about at this point, because, you know, just turning the corner isn't what needs to be done.
Mm-hmm.
We need to start heading in a new direction.
So why are the boys between 6 and 19, perhaps we can only speculate at this point, why are they immune in a bad sort of way from this awareness raising about childhood obesity?
Well, perhaps the word is susceptible here. A lot of the responsibility for the epidemic has been an increase in screen time. And if you look at the options for teenage boys, it continues to blossom. Not only do they have TV and video and high-definition TV, which is even more attractive than TV, period, you know, but we've got texting, and we've got video games, and we have got, you know, kind of almost on a daily basis, you know, other diversions that are going to take them into a pastime or an activity that is significantly different from the pastime of their older brothers, of their fathers and their uncles and their grandfathers.
Mm-hmm. Boy, I know that too. I have two boys in that demographic, the 6 to 19-year-olds, and to get them away from the screen is sometimes very, very difficult. So why boys? Is it this old cliche of boys and technology?
Why boys is I won't you know, speculate on that. It's just perhaps luck of the it's just their particular turn, because we don't, you know, by we don't want to ignore girls, and we don't want to ignore
why they're so tied to screens more so than girls.
I'm saying that girls are too. It's just that, you know, I think that perhaps a lot of the games that are being marketed right now are being marketed more at boys than girls. And in fact, maybe more of the girls have found some of those positive game activities, some of those Y-Fit type of initiatives and dance options on their games that have been of value to them.
Okay, very good. We have to take a short break. Tim Lane with us, community health consultant for the Iowa Department of Public Health. When we come back, we'll talk with Megan Harris, an epidemiologist with the Iowa Department of Public Health, talking more about the obesity epidemic among children. Also a little bit later, Operation Military Kids. Chris Gleason will be with us to talk about that. These are all things, issues, children's issues, that will be discussed tomorrow at the 4th Annual Innovation and Leadership Conference at Drake University, discussing children's issues this year. And if you'd like to join our conversation in the second half hour, please do so. Perhaps you see like to join in with what you see as the most pressing issues facing children in our state. What would you like to see addressed at this conference tomorrow? 1-866-780-9100, 1-866-780-9100, or email us, theexchange@iowapublicradio.org. I'm Ben Kiefer. We'll be back in just a few minutes. Ben Kiefer back with The Exchange, and tomorrow at this time, we'll talk with science writer Ethan Waters. His new book, Crazy Like Us, looks at how the U.S. is not only changing the way the world treats and understands mental illness, but how we are actually changing the symptoms and prevalence of the diseases themselves. Also, former Des Moines Register reporter Andrew Bleckman will be joining us. He now lives in Germany, just wrote an article for the Smithsonian Magazine about how Germans are abandoning their local butchers in favor of American-style supermarkets. that tomorrow during the noon hour here on The Exchange. Today, we're focusing on children's issues. They are the focus of the fourth annual Innovation and Leadership Conference at Drake University tomorrow, Friday. We have several people joining us to look at a number of the facets, too many of the facets to cover in this hour, but we're looking at a few of them. Amy Junkie, Director of Communications and Marketing at Lutheran Services of Iowa, talking about refugee children in Iowa, the challenges and joys of resettling those children. Also, Tim Lane with us, Community Health Consultant for the Iowa Department of Public Health. And when we left off, we were talking about the obesity epidemic. Tim, in our Des Moines studio, I had to laugh. I'm quite sure you did. Did you hear the news about the texting Olympics?
Yes, I did. That sounded like an extreme number of texts during a month.
Yeah. So with screen time, and I'm assuming texting is one of these things that one of the things that we're thinking leads to the obesity epidemic. Let's have you outline, step back, as we talked specifically about perhaps a plateau being hit. As we heard on Morning Edition this morning, step back and tell us how big the problem is of childhood obesity in this country and the risks that it poses.
The risks that it imposes is just absolutely incredible. Right now, the total cost for chronic disease in the state of Iowa is $7.6 billion. You know, that's a financial cost. The human toll is just as significant in a wide variety of ways. We're seeing our youth now come down with type 2 diabetes, which used to be referred to as adult onset diabetes. It just goes on and on and on, whether or not we're talking about cardiovascular disease, diabetes, arthritis, and mental health, those individuals. And by the way, I don't like the term obesity epidemic, because we tend to think of those 27% in Iowa that are obese, and yet the benefits of better nutrition and more physical activity will benefit probably, I'm going to guess, 90% of our population, whether or not we're talking about our youth or our adults. You know, so, you know, it's almost depressing when we look at, you know, what it's going to mean as far as the cost to us. And yet, at the other hand, we've got programs out there being promoted by Iowans Fit for Life, our basics program that is getting, you know, better nutrition choices into the classroom, our Live Healthy Iowa Kids and our Governor's Challenge that is kind of encouraging kids to be more physically active. There are some programs out there that we're excited about it, but you're absolutely right, starting with the negative aspect of it. You know, the cost and the condition and the threat to our kids is enormous.
You mentioned several programs' efforts to try to stem this rise in obesity. How will we know, or do we know at this point, that any of these programs are having an effect?
We have had studies that have given us, both, you know, from other states and within, you know, the state of Iowa, that know that oftentimes it isn't the child or even the individual that is making bad choices. It's a child or an individual in an environment that doesn't have anything but bad choices. On the nutrition side, we refer to it as a food desert. You know, if you live in a community where all that's available to eat is fast food, and go to the market and there isn't a nice variety of fresh fruit, and also the neighborhood is a little bit of a risk factor, and there isn't daily quality PE at your school, well, then you're fighting an uphill battle. But we know that when children are given the option to have and taught the value of fresh fruit and vegetables and are given an opportunity to be active, they generally respond positively to these situations. And by the way, when we were talking about those numbers for boys earlier, mm-hmm. you know, we might want to look at the number for, you know, some of the those refugees that come to America, and they generally come at a healthy weight. They might not be totally healthy, but they come at a healthy weight. Over the years, they tend to gravitate towards the American model. So they start putting on weight. If they live in a poorer neighborhood that doesn't have, you know, those particular options, and oftentimes they find it's cheaper to buy a high fat meal, you know, than a healthy one. Mm-hmm. You know, so it kind of goes beyond the individual choice. It isn't just those individuals choosing, you know, to sit in front of the TV. It becomes easier for the parents to take care of their kids with a TV and with some food that's bought at the local quick store as opposed to a bigger, more full-service grocery store.
I was amazed to see the other day in the store to combine the food and the screen time together in one thing. In the store, these highly caffeinated energy drinks now being marketed towards gamers. So they're telling you, sit longer in front of that screen to play that game and drink this drink, which has very little nutritional quality, certainly isn't any fresh fruit or vegetable, right? And this is just part of the culture that you're having to battle.
Exactly. And you can get those, you know, other very high energy but a low nutrition dense food in massive quantities. There are containers out there where you can get your drinks in that are 100 ounces. You know, I don't think we should measure them in ounces after they get past 16. That's 6 pounds. That's 6 pounds that is being sold in one serving. And for the last 20 years particularly, we have had an absolute escalation in the available calories with a decrease in the nutrition value of those calories, and at the same time have been year by year shaving off the physical activity that was engineered into our environment, which again, you know, brings up the need for us to look at quality daily PE and nutritious school lunches and safe routes to schools, where we start encouraging our children and their parents back into the habit of walking to school and letting those children arrive at school more ready to learn, you know, less kind of jittery, and having blood flow to the brain, then creating a traffic jam in front of our schools where the kids are delivered to and picked up from the school.
Mm-hmm. I want to turn to Megan Harris in just a moment of the Iowa Department of Public Health, but a final question for you, Tim Lane. Are there certain demographic groups that are more likely to be affected by obesity?
Definitely there are demographic groups, both Hispanic groups and African-American groups, that have certain medical conditions that are more prevalent. And we're obesity, overweight, inactivity, poor nutrition, all are related to the detection of those, or related to those diseases that we're tracking in those particular demographics.
Sitting with you at our Des Moines studio of Iowa Public Radio, Megan Harris, epidemiologist with the Iowa Department of Public Health. Also, I understand, a moderator for the Friday conference. Megan, hi. Good afternoon.
Hi. Good afternoon. Thanks for having me.
You're a moderator for the conference tomorrow?
Correct. I'm going to be moderating the session that Tim is speaking at tomorrow on nutrition, obesity, and the health of the child. We're going to have a speaker tomorrow talking about vaccinations as well as nutrition and obesity. Mm-hmm. And I'll also be moderating the children in the military session.
Let's talk. Continue with the obesity line here for a moment and connect it to your line of work as an epidemiologist. Does obesity put someone more at risk for infectious diseases, for H1N1, for example?
Well, that's an interesting question. I mean, it really depends on, I'd say, the pathogen and how the pathogen or infectious disease works in the body. For the first time ever, we did see a little bit of a higher propensity for the H1N1 infection to go into people that had higher weights. It's a question that we haven't faced before with influenza, and I'm sure that many people are looking at that at the state and national level.
But one thing we can say is obesity, you are not better off being obese. You are better off with fruits and vegetables, being at a weight that is more suitable to your height and frame.
Absolutely. The healthier you are, the more equipped your body is to fight off pathogenic diseases.
Megan Harris joining us from the Iowa Public Radio studios in Ames, Chris Gleason, to talk about one of our final aspects here that both of you, I'd like to have you address. Chris Gleason, Project Director for the Iowa State University Extension 4-H's Operation Military Kids. Good afternoon to you, Chris.
Good afternoon, Ben.
I want to go back to Megan, because Megan, you were a key volunteer coordinator as we talk about kids and the military for a Marine Reserve company for 3 years. What did your work involve?
Well, our work really ran the gamut
Basically, I was in charge of a group of 13 volunteers that worked with 225 Marine families in 15 states. And we met the basic needs of those families, anything stemming from a mother running out of formula and diapers to somebody needing assistance with a phone bill so they could keep in contact with their service member.
And you had some great recognition on a national level for this work, didn't you?
We did. Thank you for mentioning. In 2007, our battalion, comprised of five companies, including our own, was awarded recognition for having the best family readiness program in the nation for the Marine Corps.
Well, congratulations. Belated, but congratulations nevertheless. And I understand also your husband at the time was deployed to Iraq twice in the 3 years.
That's correct. He was.
An amazing performance there. What's most important for military kids? I want to ask this of both of you, but starting off with Megan, what's most important for military kids? What do they need that kids who are in non-military families don't get?
Kids in military families need an intense amount of support and stability, affirmation. They really need routine. They need familiarity, and they need to feel very comfortable on a daily basis to know that they're loved and they're secured, because having a parent or a loved one when you're a child deployed for a long period of time, especially when you can't understand what a deployment is or where that loved one is and for how long, those types of securities are absolutely essential for the growth and development of that child.
So if we don't have that support there, that security, what could possibly develop that we want to avoid?
Well, children, I think, could have developmental regressions. I think that's fairly common. They have adjustment issues when the service member returns.
Regressions? What do you mean specifically by a regression?
Oh, things like they have issues with toilet training. They stop eating or communicating well. We've seen children with anger issues, children with emotional issues that tend to display themselves in school. And those types of things are difficult to deal with when you have a child that's, say, you know, preschool age that can't really communicate well.
Let me turn to Chris Gleason of Iowa State University Extension 4-H's Operation Military Kids. Tell us, what is the mission of Operation Military Kids, Chris?
The mission of Operation Military Kids is to make sure that we help communities to provide those support networks for military kids where they live. As Megan just said, that creating that safe environment for military kids is really key to making sure that they do build resiliencies and those coping skills to make sure that family survives while that soldier is deployed, mm-hmm. making sure that those child care providers have the resources and the education and training that they need, make sure that those teachers that work with those kids on a daily basis have the resources and trainings that they need to support those kids throughout the deployment cycle before, during, and after deployment.
What do you see as the biggest challenges in dealing with military kids and the effects of these deployments?
I think that as a whole, the community of Iowa has become a little bit fatigued with the war. I think that we have we've put aside the issues that these kids face, and we've just gone on with our lives, and that we need to recreate that awareness, especially with this coming year when we've got 3,500 Iowa National Guard soldiers scheduled to deploy come the end of the summer. So what Operation Military Kids is doing now with our partners is making sure that we're out of there in our communities, out there in our school districts, creating that awareness, getting people up to speed, making sure people have the training and the resources that they need now, because these kids are starting to be aware, okay, my parent is going to be leaving here in just a few months. And those teachers and the child care providers, everyone that works with those kids, community members, a soccer coach, they all need to know where they can find resources, what they need to do to help create that safe environment and support those kids.
Well, can you give us some web addresses? Where can people turn to?
Certainly. Iowa State University Extension, we have our website up on our 4-H website. So it's www.extension.iastate.edu/4-H. And then just click on the program area, Operation Military Kids.
Chris, can you give me a red flag or two of, say, someone in a military family is missing, is listening right now with a child involved? What would be a typical sort of red flag behavioral issue that might surface that where you'd say, well, it's possibly time to reach out for some help?
I think, as Megan told you, that the fact that the regression in potty training or eating or sleeping, kids that are in high school maybe becoming apathetic, not caring about their schoolwork, typical stress reactions that you see in kids on a general basis are what you're going to see on military kids when they're under stress, too. We have a lot of mental health counselors out there in the state that are – we're also training them as well. The military is doing – an incredible job doing some training with mental health counselors. They've got our military family life consultants here in Iowa. We have two of them that are specifically working with military families. Military One Source is another great resource for military families. It's got free counseling, free online support, lots of resources available. So the military has learned from lessons past, and they're working very hard to bring up to speed all the resources that families need, especially here in Iowa, where we don't have any military installations and our families are geographically dispersed, and they can't find those resources that they usually have on large installations. So we're making sure that those resources are out there in the communities where the families live, work, and play.
Do you feel that the military is doing enough to support these families?
I think they're working as hard as they can. Yes, if you look back, even we started Operation Military Kids in January of 2004. Iowa was one of five states that was able to go out there and help design the program with U.S. Army Child, Youth, and School Services. And if you look at what we were just starting then and what is in place now, not just here in Iowa with Operation Military Kids, but on a national level from the Office of the Secretary of Defense and all the service branches, I think you would see an incredible response to the needs of these military families.
Mm-hmm. I want to take a specific scene, being in a non-military family. I wonder how you would give guidance to a military family, being interested, of course, in what is happening in Iraq, what is happening in Afghanistan, especially during a deployment of a family member. How do you deal with the news, whether that be from the web or the radio, or the TV? Of course, you're very interested in it, but for children, you don't necessarily want to subject them to the daily headlines of loss of life.
If I'm understanding your question right, you're talking about what a non-military family would do.
No, what a military family would do.
Oh, what a military family would do. We certainly recommend that you turn off the TV. You don't want to have children exposed to that. When you have your adult conversations, you want to have your children away from those adult conversations because children are emotional sponges. They'll soak it up. In fact, the research that's just been coming out, there's a couple very important research papers that came out, and it talked about how the children are affected by the mental health status of the parents, the at-home parent. So we need to make sure that the adults are getting the mental health counseling and support that they need, and that's going to help the children that are affected by the status of the parents.
What kinds of things do you do to get these kids together, to share experiences? Because I understand being together, military kids,
right,
being together is a real key here. So
that
so.
Sense of belonging is very important, not only for military kids, but for any kid. We talk about that for 4-H, for positive youth development, the need to belong, and making sure that that environment where they are belonging is a safe environment, both physically and emotionally. And some of the stuff that we have done, we've received funding from the Secretary of Defense to have Operation Military Kids camps in the summertime. Last year we had five camps out at the Iowa 4-H Center, and this year we've just submitted a grant to have four more camps here in Iowa this summer, and we serve almost 100 kids at those camps. And what the kids say, you go to camp and you meet another military kid and you don't have to explain what your life is like. They understand immediately what it's like.
Because,
and so that's that sense of belonging.
Mm-hmm. So, but when they go back to their regular elementary school, they are in a minority. And then they do have to do some explaining,
right,
and are confronted perhaps by last night's news.
Right. And often the kids at camp have stayed connected with each other. The Iowa National Guard has has other support groups that help military kids. We have our Speak Out for Military Kids teen group. The resources that we provide for teachers in their classrooms helps them work with the other classmates of the kids who
right.
have a parent deployed. When we talk about kids in Iowa with a deployed soldier or a parent in the military, there's about 10,000 kids with a parent in the military. But when you look at the other kids that are affected by deployment, it's just about everyone. Because like you said, when that child goes back to the classroom, and if they're struggling and having problems, the teacher's going to have to focus on that child that's acting out. The other kids are going to wonder what's going on. So it's very important for that teacher to help the other children understand and empathize with that child that's in the classroom, and we provide resources for them to do that.
To classroom teachers, to raise awareness and make them aware of the sacrifices these children, these families are making.
There's a motto that the National Military Family Association says, that kids serve too, and that is certainly true, because when the parents deployed, the kids are also a part of that deployment fully.
And before we have to go, let's make sure people know how to contact you. More information at OperationMilitaryKids.org.
That's another of our websites. That's our national website, right? And then our state website is www.extension.iastate.edu/4-H, and then click on Operation Military Kids Program.
Okay. Thank you very much, Chris Gleason, joining us from Iowa Public Radio Studios in Ames. Project Director for Iowa State University Extension, 4-H's Operation Military Kids. And we want to thank all the participants in the program today. Megan Harris with the Iowa Department of Health, also Tim Lane with the Iowa Department of Health, talking about obesity and also about military families, how they military and being at war affects kids. At the beginning of our program, Amy Junkie, Director of Communications and Marketing at Lutheran Services of Iowa. I think you're all still there. I want to thank you very much for a great hour of conversation. The Exchange is produced by Catherine Perkins and Jeff Schmidt, our producer assistants today, David Henderson and Christoph Mai. Podcasting and on-demand audio of The Exchange available by going to iowapublicradio.org. Our theme music was composed and performed by Dan Knight. The Exchange is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us.